financial literacy, and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Raham.
Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor. I'm Denise Fozella, along with Dr. Frances Raham of Hug Your Student Debt. This show is made possible by Greenfield Community College, increasing access to higher education at a fraction of the cost, and by People's United Bank of Amherst, home of Tea with Trish. And this morning, we're talking with Dr. Frances Raham about something that is that all of us do at some point, and that is procrastination. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Denise?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. It sounds a little negative, I guess, but I'm looking at it actually in a positive way. And believe it or not, some of the things that we have, some of the reasons that cause us to procrastinate can have a positive effect on us as well as a negative effect.
Okay.
Which was a surprise to me a bit.
That is a surprise, but I'm willing to play along with that.
fair enough. I like everything to be positive if it's possible. But I am fascinated by this topic because of all the things that can get in our way about getting out of debt, it seems that procrastination is at the top of the list. And none of us, nobody comes into my office and says, I know the reason I'm in debt is because I procrastinate. They'll list it as one of many topics. You know, well, we had these things that happened to us financially, and then there was this problem, and then this other stuff happened, and I just kept putting it off. So I wanted to know, and I've been asking for years, what caused you to put it off?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, people sometimes will tell us that they heard me on the radio or they saw us on TV for years before they came in. And they'll say things like, oh, I wish I did this sooner, right? And I'll ask, well, why? Why didn't you do it sooner?
What are some of the answers that you get?
Well, I was hoping to find one or two things that I could just point and say, if I can solve this problem, I can help people not to procrastinate. But it turns out that there are, you know, there's just a litany of reasons that people procrastinate. And so one of the things is that the goal might seem to be too abstract, right?
That makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, it's just too vague. I want to get out of debt.
Yeah, what does that mean?
I want to lose weight. Mm-hmm. I want to be a millionaire, you know. It's just, I want to be a millionaire, I guess, is a little more specific, but still not enough, right? So when we say, I want to get out of debt, it just seems like, who doesn't, right? But if we can be very specific and say, I want to pay my credit cards off in 2 years, I want to pay my mortgage off in 6, I want to have a budget I can live with, I want to do these specific things. And we do help people with that, with coaching, but in the beginning, they don't know that. All they know is somebody's offering to help them get out of debt. And so I think this is in part why people fall prey to some of those programs that all you have to do is, you know, call up and sign a piece of paper and they're going to take care of everything and get you out of debt, because it's unthinkable about how you will manage that one piece at a time when it seems like an overwhelming goal.
So it's hard to connect with that goal because it's so abstract. And then it might be difficult to even comprehend the amount of debt that we have.
Yeah.
To face the goal.
Facing the goal is tough sometimes. It's why we ask people to put in their information in the website, and then they will see how much debt they actually have on paper, not just a sense of it, and not just saying, well, this is what I have in credit card debt, right? When they see what they're paying out in mortgages and student loans and car payments and all of that, then they can see it. And once we can see it, with a click of a button, they can see what their current timelines are and what our timelines are individually. So we can get very specific, and instead of being abstract, we can say, oh, look, there's your credit card paid off in 3 months. There's your car paid off in 20 months, whatever it happens to be. There's your mortgage in, you know, 6 years. And so then it's easier to move forward with the plan. But initially, just getting people to go and put information in the system, we all know, okay, we've got debt. Otherwise, we wouldn't be thinking about this. And that form seems really scary, right? There's a thing called form fear.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to put information into a form. So there's about a million reasons why people could procrastinate.
So many fears. Fear really sounds like it's at the root of procrastination. And avoidance is one of those ways that fear gets manifested. I remember, and I'm not going to say who, I don't want to throw this person under the bus, but I remember as a child seeing somebody's mail piled up on the table, bills unopened, did not even open them to see what they were. And if the phone rang, it was not answered because it was a bill collector.
Yes. So I'm going to take a stab in the dark and say that that person also suffered from some anxiety. And there's something called a feedback loop. When anxiety is present and it's a task that they really don't want to look at and they procrastinate, the procrastination causes them to feel more anxious. And there's this awful feedback loop. And the longer it goes on, the more the stronger the aversion is. And stacked up bills is a perfect example of that.
Yeah.
You know, now on the other side, you could say is there's that lottery idea, right? As long as I don't open the envelope, I'm a wealthy person, right? As long as I don't open the envelope, I don't know what that bill is. And so believe it or not, there's also a thing about procrastination that people put it off for a sense of excitement, if you can imagine that. So think of a student who will not cram for a test until the night before.
Oh, right.
Because they see that process as being tedious or boring, or they don't think they're going to do it well. And somehow waiting until the last minute causes the excitement to grow and very often can cause a positive result as well as a negative result, depending on the person and how they process that.
Brings about an adrenaline rush in a way.
I guess so. It's not something I do. I personally like to get my ducks in a row and have them done. But, you know, we all have these reasons we procrastinate. One of the most interesting things I thought was optimism. Optimism can cause people to procrastinate.
And, how so?
Well, you think, okay, this is a problem now, but I'm going to get a raise soon, or my business is going to do better, or after I graduate, I'm going to make all this money. So I'm optimistic toward the future, and that means I don't have to look at getting out of debt now, because it's all going to be okay someday. So I tend to be an optimist. I tend to have, you know, lots of fresh ideas, and I always want to put off whatever I'm working on now to get to the next fresh idea. So the whole underlying issue here is our behavioral patterns, right? Our sense of self-control and willpower. And I think most people would say, oh, if you procrastinate, you don't have good self-control or you don't have good willpower. But I would say that might only be true in a certain area. You might have great self-control or great willpower in other areas of your life. Maybe you're terrific at your job or with your parenting skills or, helping other people. But when it comes to your own stuff, your own finances, it's just too icky to want to look at. And so we put it off.
And I certainly did that as well. You're listening to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Ryan of Hug Your Student Debt. And I am her co-host, Denise Vozella, the news director here at WHMP. And it took me at least a few months of hearing your commercials on our radio station before I called you. And then I had to go home and have that conversation with my husband before we called you, that I told him, explained to him what I heard in the commercials and what I thought this might be able to do for us. I brought it up before, that lifeline that we were looking for. And so even I procrastinated in calling you.
And think about that, because you were really very close to the situation. You knew there was credibility because I was here at your station, right? And even with that, there's still that obstacle. There's still whatever reason it is. And I think it's different for everybody. I mean, there's lots and lots of reasons. One of the things that I thought was very interesting is that we might see the problem as happening to a future self. And we don't have a real connection to that. So an example would be, my doctor says I have diabetes. And if I don't change the way I eat now, 2 to 3 years from now, I could have a real medical problem. Okay, so I might perceive that, if I'm good at procrastination and denial, I might perceive that as something that doesn't have a sense of urgency. It doesn't need action right now. It's going to happen to me 2 to 3 years in the future. And I almost see that as happening to a future self.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if somebody said, you have a medical problem that requires you to change your diet, this is what you need to eat now, very specifically, and you need to do it now or a week from now, you're not going to be here to tell us about it, then that might cause me to take action immediately and not procrastinate so much. Unfortunately, with debt, it's less, I think it's still life-threatening, but it's less medically life-threatening. And so even though people know, okay, this is really coming to get you and there's a problem, until people reach what they perceive as the bottom, the rock bottom, they don't move to get out of debt. Now, for some people, rock bottom is just that they just can't send any extra to their debt this month, and that disturbs them. And other people have to have, you know, a letter telling them they're going to court. But that's what happens when people you know, don't have a connection with our future self about the debt.
So what do you do about that? Other than picking up the phone and calling you or going to your website and filling out the form.
Sure. Well, what one thing you can do is you can take something like that that might seem overwhelming, for instance, or seem abstract, and break it into very specific pieces and begin to make a plan. Now, you don't have to make the whole plan, right? That's another thing we procrastinate about, believe it or not, is this idea of perfectionism. Okay, we're going to get out of debt. Let's sit down and make the plan, and it must be right from the start, and let's make sure we read all the books and we do all the stuff. Just take one step, one tiny little step. Whatever it is for you is okay. If it happens to be calling us, great. If it happens to be just sitting down and saying, today I'm going to track all the expenses I spend, and I'm going to start to get a handle on what I'm spending. Tomorrow I'm going to go and fill out a form online. On Wednesday, I'm going to call a coach. On Friday, I'm going to call an attorney. Whatever it happens to be very specific about it and make it immediate. Make it so that you're doing it right now. Because after you just make the very first step, the rest of the stuff gets easier. It falls into place.
Once you take that first step, I've heard that that can create motivation to keep going, right?
Yeah.
That it gives you that inspiration. Oh, I've done this. Now I can do more.
That's absolutely true. You know, we're talking about self-control and willpower, and those are the things that can get in our way, right? There can be demotivating factors. Things like, I'm just exhausted when I come home at the end of the day, and I keep telling myself I'm going to fill out the form or get out of debt or do whatever, but I just don't have it. I'm done. I'm depleted, right? So every time you make decisions like this, you're depleting your mental reserves a bit. And when you're trying to make a lot of decisions, you're exhausting your mind to some extent. And so until you recharge your batteries, you're not going to be able to really get out of debt the right way, right? So one thing you can do is figure out when you're best. If you're best in the morning, don't put it off until the end of the night. Take a morning on a weekend or sometime when you can and start working on it right away, but only do little bits at a time.
Great advice from the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Ryan of Hug Your Student Debt. And we are going to take this quick break. We'll be right back with part two of our conversation about why do we procrastinate so long about getting out of debt. Welcome back to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Ryan of Hug Your Student Debt. I'm your co-host, Denise Fozella, and we thank the people who make this show possible. People's United Bank of Amherst, home of Tea with Trish, and Greenfield Community College, increasing access to higher education at a fraction of the cost. This morning, we're talking about why we procrastinate so long about getting out of debt. And it's something a lot of us do. It's almost universal, isn't it, Frances?
I think procrastination in general, is just an interesting topic because we all do it. I do it. Nobody's immune to it, right? And sometimes it has a positive effect and sometimes it has a negative effect. Some people, if they're afraid of being judged, which is one of the reasons we might procrastinate, that can drive them toward solving a problem. I don't want my relatives to see my name in the paper that I couldn't pay my bills one day and I had to file a bankruptcy, so I better get on this and get out of debt. But most of the time, I think the fear of being judged or, any of the fears that we have get in our way. And it's just very difficult to overcome those until there's some catalyst, there's some reason that you suddenly feel, okay, today is the day I have to do this, right?
Mm-hmm.
I would prefer to have people not feel that way, not be pressed into it, and start to see this as a positive approach to money management.
I think
that would be great.
That there's also, in some cases, a fear of deprivation, that if I take this step, then I'm not going to be able to do the things that I want to be able to do. And I don't
right.
want someone else telling me what I can and can't do with my money.
Right.
So there might be that kind of fear of control, a lack of control.
So that's why I'm the money doctor and not the money monster.
Okay. Yeah.
Because I had this problem. I was in a lot of debt, and I had to be able to get out of it, and I didn't want to sacrifice my lifestyle. So what we did was create a system that could get you out using the same money you're already spending, and sometimes less, right? Sometimes I look at people's numbers and I just say, no wonder you're taking on credit card debt. You simply have been loaded up with too much debt. Your payments are too high. And so we have to adjust that. So I think, ironically, people expect that I will, the first thing we will say is, okay, don't use your credit cards, freeze your debt. You're now on the ramen noodle diet for the rest of your life. And by the way, no vacations. You're not going to buy a car. And this is what you're doing for the next 8 years. If you want to get out of debt, you must live in privation. And the truth is, we know that won't work. That's a foolish way to go at it. In order for someone to have a successful debt plan, they have to be able to live a decent lifestyle. They have to feel better about their money. It's the same as a diet. You cannot lose weight long-term on some diet that is unrealistic. And you know there will be a birthday party or the holiday where you're going to want to eat that food and has to be allowable. So it isn't that we tell people you can just spend willy-nilly and still get out of debt. That would be ridiculous, right? Mm-hmm. But they don't have to worry that we're going to cramp their lifestyle because we're really working with exactly what they have now.
I think also there's a lot of anxiety around this whole thought of getting out of debt. I mean, what does that even mean? We spoke earlier about wrapping your mind around that, but it creates a lot of that kind of anxious feeling.
Money in general, I think, I find creates that for people. Even if they think they're very good at investing, there might be a part of the financial picture that they're not happy about, like the debt, or speaking to their partner about it, and that really elevates our emotions. And so whenever, you know, it's sort of the fight or flight thing, right? Whenever we're faced with something that's very dangerous like that, or we perceive it as being very dangerous, it all seems larger. Everything seems magnified. So you were talking earlier about you had a conversation with your husband about, you know, getting out of debt. And I know we're going to get your full story someday because you've offered it to us.
Yes.
But, you know, just leading up to that, the conversation itself is almost never as scary as we think it will be. When, you know, we're thinking about getting out of debt, it just seems overwhelming. And really, it can be done very methodically. And the odd part is staying in debt is the what should be really, really overwhelming. But because we're already there and the payments go out every month, you know, we just let it go on, and taking action to get out requires a little courage.
You're reminding me of some of the things that I've gone through with regard to money in my lifetime. And one of my fears has been in the past that I can't face it. I don't have it in me to face everything. So it's just too overwhelming.
Yeah. And that can be true not only in a general sense, but in a very specific sense. Like we call it task aversion. The best example I can think of in terms of money is usually building a budget. Most people, when you say the word budget, will just about run screaming, you know, because it conjures up this image of, you know, I use this analogy, trying to cram a size 12 foot into a size 9 shoe, right? And so the task seems so awful, we don't want to do it. Who wants to have that terrible medical exam that you didn't really want to have? But sometimes you're forced into that medically. But with debt, you're not so much forced into it. And it can be really scary. And one of the reasons for that, I think, is that the perceived reward is so far out in the future. Sure, I'd love to get out of debt, but gee, 10 years seems like a long time, or 5 years seems like a long time. We don't really see it as, okay, I want to get out today, I pick up the phone, I make a phone call, and I'm out of debt, problem solved. Check the box, move on, right? Mm-hmm. It takes some, my mother used to say moxie, right? It takes a little moxie, that's a really old word, to face it, right? But what are your alternatives, really? I mean, you can stay in debt for a long time, and you can continue to try to get out of it, trying different things, and maybe you'll be successful and maybe you won't. But even that compounds it, Denise.
What I have found in every single case that I've ever faced something that I was afraid of, the fear was much worse than the reality, and it actually facing the issue, and money has been definitely right up there. Facing it has eliminated a lot of the anxiety.
Yeah, facing it and having a solution.
Yes.
So just facing it is a little
step
bit like
one.
Yeah, it's a little bit like hitting your head on that brick wall. You know, most people who have debt have faced it many times. And the reason they might have a fear of failure is because that's the reinforcement they've gotten. I tried this. It didn't work. I ended up back in debt. I tried that. It didn't work. Here I am again back in debt. Every time you do that, your resources are worn down a little bit more and a little bit more. and you become more suspect about whether you will ever be able to accomplish that or not.
Your emotional resources. Yeah.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And when you think that you might fail, that fear of failure is enough to procrastinate. I don't want to look at that. Okay, here's a great example. A student might procrastinate about taking the exam and might fail the exam rather than studying for the exam, because they would almost rather that the procrastination, the fear of taking the exam, the procrastination was the reason to blame instead of they didn't understand the material. People will perceive all of these things as, you know, a series of huge hurdles. You know, I'm afraid to face this. I feel really anxious about it. So there's the anxiety.
It's overwhelming.
Part. There's the task. Right. It's overwhelming. There's the task aversion. I really hate to look at money. There's the form fear. I don't want to fill out a form because I'm afraid somebody will have my information. I might fail. So I'm not sure I want to do that. I'm going to have to call that person and I'm going to be judged. They're going to tell me that I didn't make good decisions or, you know, so we try to remove all those obstacles. The thing that makes it work for people is if they can just get over the hurdle and begin to take the steps to get out of debt, fill out the form or call us or whatever, then you're going to get a coach who is experienced, who went through what you're going through right now, because I don't hire anybody that hasn't been a client, right? So they've been through what you've been through, and they understand it, and they'll listen and help you with whatever it is that might be happening for you in procrastination, because we're all different.
So motivation can start to happen. Motivation to stop procrastinating can start to happen when you just take one step.
Yeah, I think so. You know, there's no doubt about that, that any one step is progress. It doesn't have to be the whole plan. One of the things that we say in the investment world, and it's true in debt as well, is that people suffer from analysis paralysis. I want to get out of debt. It seems like such a big project that must mean it requires a lot of effort, a lot of research, a lot of planning, a lot of time. And so I go out there and I want to make the perfect decision. I want to make sure I'm not getting ripped off, and I want to make sure that I have the best debt plan possible. And so I read and I read and I read and I send away and I talk to people and I fill out forms, but I never quite pull the trigger because I'm not sure which one's the right one. And that's like saying I don't start my diet because I'm not sure which diet I want to start. Any diet would help you get to your goal, right? And it's the same with debt. Just start to do something, anything, toward changing the direction that you're going in.
And I want to ask about the having a partner in this process, a spouse or a living arrangement, someone that you have, that you share debt with, that you have to get on board. And what if they're the procrastinator? How do you overcome that?
Well, there's always divorce, you know. No. So what can you do? Well, you know, you can do a few things, I think. And I don't profess to have all the answers to this. I just want to help people.
And you have helped a lot of people. You've seen a lot of cases.
Yes. Yeah. Thousands of people, for sure. So what can you do? Well, it depends on the spouse and it depends on your relationship. If you have a good, solid relationship and you can have this discussion, make it a pleasant discussion. You know, it's not drudgery, you know, make a nice dinner. It's not a surprise attack. Tell them in the beginning, I've got a problem. I'm managing the household finances and, you know, I don't want it to be scary, but you know, we've had a conversation several times about doing something and we can't quite get there. And in order to get there, I think we have to agree on what direction we're going to take. So can we talk about it after dinner and, you know, and even say, look, I'll handle the bulk of this because I'm the one doing it, but I need you on board with me. And see what they'll say. Usually people are pretty happy to help rather than be in the doghouse. Yeah. Yeah.
So we are talking about procrastination with regard to getting out of debt with the Money Doctor this morning. And how can people contact you, Dr. Frances Ram, and what can they expect when they get someone else either on your website or on the phone?
Sure. They can reach us at 413-774-5555 or 773-3333. Or on the web at hugyourstudentdebt.org or powerdowndebt.com. And what they can expect when they get someone on the phone is that there will be a live person. You won't be stuck in a phone tree. If we're not available right at the moment because we're in session, we'll get back to you as quickly as we can. But you'll get a real person to talk to who will be firsthand knowledgeable about what is going on for you and can answer any questions and schedule a consultation for you or a webinar or whatever is appropriate and whatever works with your schedule.
Thank you, Dr. Frances Ram of Hug Your Student Debt. This has been Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, made possible by Greenfield Community College, increasing access to higher education at a fraction of the cost, and by People's United Bank of Amherst, home of Tea with Trish. If you missed any portion of this program or want to hear any of the programs in this series, you can hear the podcasts all at WHMP.com. I'm Denise Bozella. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. We'll be back again next week.
Financial literacy and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Ram.
Welcome to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Ram. Hi.
Good morning, Jess. How are you?
I'm good. So we get to actually see each other, which is lovely. Today we are talking about a topic which is really funny because I just heard a funny commercial about it, and it's life insurance.
Oh, really? What, you heard a funny commercial about life insurance? Do tell.
I didn't know how it would work, but it was this commercial that came on that basically said, like, if you're overweight and don't take care of yourself and you're, you know, one step away, call Big Dave because we'll insure even you. And I just thought, is this working? But it must be because they're advertising.
Well, Big Dave might know a little something about that. Actually,
it's basically the people that don't want to have to pass like the doctor's requirement part of it, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a kind of it is a funny commercial, but it's meant to be disarming, I'm sure. And it does speak about a very specific kind of life insurance. And so we're going to go over today the different kinds of life insurance, the reasons you might have it, try to sort out some of this mystery about some of the things that are less known than others, and give you some idea about why you might need or not need life insurance, how you figure that out, and what kind would be best for you to get so that you don't fall prey to, well, a big day.
I'm also curious if we have time to touch on whether there's ever a time that what you get from your employee, you know, when you can times your salary, is that ever enough?
So I'm curious from your employer? Mm-hmm. Yeah, from your employer. Yeah, it might be. But okay, so let's start there and we'll talk about Big Dave too. And then we'll go on to other things because I feel like I'm picking on poor Dave. And there's a place for what Dave is saying to do. So, okay. So what you get from your employer, let's say it's three times your salary. Is it enough? Maybe. And maybe while you're still working, what you need to understand is what happens to it when you leave work. Do you get to keep a reduced amount? Like, let's say you have $150,000 of coverage while you're working. If you leave, does your employer say you get to keep a $5,000, say, paid up policy, or you get to pay the premiums on it and keep it? So They can say anything they want about it, basically. It's one of your benefits. You might want to ask your HR people, what happens to my life insurance when I leave? So that you know, Because one of the biggest things about life insurance is, and everybody will tell you this, if you buy it when you're young and healthy, it will be cheaper. Mm-hmm. The rub is that when you're young and healthy, you often can't afford much life insurance.
Or you're not really thinking about it. You know, you think you're going to be young and healthy forever.
Yeah, it's true. But okay, so let's talk about Big Dave for a minute.
Okay.
But he's talking about, I'm assuming, and I've not heard the ad, but I'm assuming that he's talking about something we call guaranteed issue life insurance. So just to give you a rough overview, there's so many different kinds of life insurance. There's whole life. There's variable life. There's universal life. There's variable universal life. There's term insurance.
It gets confusing.
Yeah, it gets confusing. And most people don't start by saying, what kind of life insurance do I need? They start by saying, how much life insurance do I need? And then the usual comment is, I'll just get term because it's cheaper. Mm-hmm. Or, no, I want permanent insurance because I don't want it to end.
Can you explain the difference between term and permanent or term and life?
Absolutely. Term and permanent life insurance. Okay, so term insurance is just what it sounds like. It's there for a certain term.
Right? Okay.
It might be 10-year term, 15-year term, 20-year term, 30-year term.
But so not to be, that basically means you have to die within that time period.
Wow, that's a little harsh.
A little hard. I just... I didn't pretty that up at all. But that's basically what it means, right?
I don't think anybody would buy a policy that says they have to die within the term.
If you don't die within this 10 years, you're getting nothing.
But that's kind of how it works, actually. If you don't die within that period of time, the premiums you've paid are gone, right? They've been paying for death benefit only, no cash value, and the policy ends. Okay, so that's term insurance. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about how term can benefit you in a number of ways, but that's how term insurance works versus some sort of permanent insurance, like any kind of whole life, variable life, universal life, variable universal life, those things that build cash value in some way. That's the basic difference. If you don't know if you have term or you have some whole life product and you can't find the words on your statement, do you build cash value or do you not? Mm-hmm. Now, the gray area, there's always a gray area. You might have something like, say, a universal life policy built on a term chassis. So you might be paying for permanent insurance, but as cheaply as you can. Mm-hmm. But it's still permanent. It's just not building any or much cash value.
Okay.
So it is. It's a hot mess, right? Insurance is a hot
mess. For sure.
But there are ways to sort through it. So that's the difference between term and permanent insurance. And permanent insurance, we would call some form of whole life contract. As I said, universal life, variable life, any of those are under the permanent insurance umbrella.
And the whole life is obviously going to be more expensive.
Yes, it is going to be more expensive. And depending on the kind of whole life you buy, it will cost you more in premiums than some others. For instance, a universal life policy may be less expensive than what we call a plain vanilla whole life policy. The question isn't always one of expense, though. The question is often one of value.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how expensive was your term policy if you paid for it for 25 years and didn't use it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It did cover your death benefit, and that's what you wanted it to do. But now you're 25 years older, you may not be in good health, and you might be in the market for insurance again, and now you're going to really pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas some whole life types of policies, universal life is a good example, where you might be able to pay for it for a period of time, it builds up enough cash value to start paying for itself. And it's still permanent insurance. It's not that one of these is better than the other. It's that you have to find the right fit for you.
Is there a time that you would recommend someone get either a term or a whole life insurance policy? Is there a certain age or other factors?
Well, if you're going to die, I think it's a good idea to have some life insurance.
But I mean, would you take it out when you're 30 or would you take it out when you're 60?
Yeah, clearly taking it out when you're younger helps. But life changes. You might need a lot more insurance when you're 30 and you have three small children at home and not a lot of assets and a wife or a husband that maybe can't support themselves without your income.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, that's a cause for life insurance, right?
Yeah.
You might take it out if you have a business partner who can't run the business successfully if you die without some real capital. So you might take out life insurance and make the business partner the beneficiary on it. So if something happens to you, the business can continue to run, thereby perhaps supporting your family.
Mm-hmm.
Some people will buy it to build cash value tax-free. If they buy a whole life policy and it's funded a specific way and it doesn't breach some guidelines, which you know upfront, you know, then you might build cash value in there tax-free. That I could go on for about an hour about, but I won't. I'll just say, if someone is selling you a policy telling you you're going to be able to take that cash out tax-free in the future, in my opinion, it better be a big policy. It better be big enough to make that worthwhile. Because when you get these really large policies, you know, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, $30,000 a month going into a policy like that, you can build a pile of money that you can take out tax-free in the future. And that
Do
might
you
be
get taxed on it when you take it out or no?
Not if you take it out by loaning it against the policy, which is why I say the policy has to be so large, because if you still want some death benefit, you want to be able to borrow some money against the policy and still keep your death benefit. When you take money out of your whole life type of out of your permanent life insurance policy, how do you do it? Some people will cash it in. They get a policy, it's got some cash value in it. They see the cash value and they don't think they need the death benefit. So they cash it in and they take the money. That becomes taxable.
Okay.
That's then a taxable event. Now, I have to say, of course, my disclaimer, I'm not an accountant, right?
But that becomes taxable. If you borrow the money against your own death benefit, it's a tax-free transaction as long as you didn't reach that MECA guideline we're talking about. Let's say you have a $5 million policy and it's built up, I don't know, $300,000 of capital. These are ridiculous numbers, but let's just use them. If you take out, you know, $200,000 as a loan against the policy, you don't have to pay it back. You're borrowing your own death benefit. It will accrue interest. So the loan will continue to grow against your death benefit. But if you die, they just subtract it from the death benefit.
I'm assuming that you would recommend then always borrowing against and not taking it out and getting that big tax penalty.
Usually, yes.
Okay. I mean,
there are times that it makes sense. I've seen people who have built up more cash value than their death benefit is. You know, it's an old policy that a parent bought for them when they were a child or something. They've built up, you know, $15,000 of cash value and they only have $5,000 death benefit. I mean, it's tricky. What you need to do is find an insurance agent that you can trust who's speaking to you and helping you sort these things out in some way that makes sense. I mean, us trying to go through, you know, a life insurance tutorial in half an hour is tricky at best and certainly not, you know, conclusive. So yeah, I said I wanted to talk about Big Dave for a minute.
Okay.
So Big Dave is talking, I think, about another kind of life insurance, which is called guaranteed issue or guarantee issue, depending on who you speak with. Guaranteed issue is something you see it from AARP and some other companies. Sometimes you'll get a flyer in the mail that says no exam necessary, you know, answer three medical questions or no questions, no exam necessary. And there's always some tricky phrase like your premiums will never go up or your death benefit can never go down, right?
Yeah.
Usually the way these things happen is, yes, they will issue them on a guaranteed basis. For instance, I've seen people who have somebody in their family who is terminally ill. They know it. There's no money to pay for a funeral. And the person's been given 2 years to live, right? Well, they might roll the dice and say, we're going to take out a guaranteed issue product because they're not going to get issued in any other kind of insurance. And we're going to make these premium payments, hoping, of course, that their loved one lives longer than the entry period, which is usually 2 or 3 years. And so the way it works is something like this, usually. You're going to pay in your premiums. If the person dies after, say, the three-year mark, you're going to get the whole death benefit. So let's say you're buying a $10,000 policy and you're paying in, you know, $200 a month or whatever the premium is. If they die after the three-year mark, they've basically made the grade and you're going to get paid the full death benefit. If they die prior to the three-year mark, you will usually, I know AARP had a product like this, I don't know if they still do, but you would get all your premiums back that you paid plus some interest. And they had a pretty good thing. It was like if they died in the second year, don't quote me on this, but it was something like you got 25% more than your money back or whatever. So you get a reduced death benefit, but it still might be worth doing because you know, you're going to get all your premiums back anyway if you take that kind of policy. But read the small print because it may not be that way. I mean, I remember that as being one of the better guaranteed issue policies you could buy. But that's, I think, what Big Dave's talking about. And it isn't that people don't want to go through the physicals, although I'm sure, you know, people get frightened about that, but it's pretty minimal what they'll do. They'll usually send a paramed to your house. They'll ask you some questions by phone, you know, they'll get your doctor's records if they need to. But if you're in that situation, maybe not even terminally ill, but just let's say you have a heart problem. Okay, well, you might go for traditional insurance and you might get what we call rated. In other words, you might get a higher premium because you're seen as a higher risk, or you might get declined. If you're declined, you might be calling Big Dave, all right, or preferably searching the market for the best terms you can get on a guaranteed issue contract.
Okay, I have another question on this, which we will get to in the second half, but first I do want to get your phone number.
Absolutely, Jess. It's 413-773-3333.
And you can go to hugyourmoney.com as well. We'll be right back with the second half of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Ram. It's coming up on WHMP. Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Ram. Hi, I'm always happy when you're still there. I had a question that I wanted to ask you kind of about Big Dave. So when you're laying in bed at 2 in the morning and can't sleep and you see those infomercials that are kind of the same thing as Big Dave, where it's like, call now, we're going to guarantee this. It's $5 a month and you can get however much. How do you know if it's a scam or not? Because a lot of those just seem way too good to be true.
Well, they may not be a scam. Like, for instance, Big Dave, who we're giving a lot of free advertising to, and I have nothing, I have no idea whether Big Dave's product is any good or not. So please, you know that we're using him as an example here because you had seen that commercial. It's not necessarily that they're a scam, but they may not be the best deal for you. And that's where I would go to somebody that has some real clout and something to lose, like an AARP who has such a big volume of people that they go and they get really good rates from someone, you know, from a company. I think I remember that contract I was talking to you about was underwritten by New York Life, but it was special terms for AARP. They were competitive terms to New York Life's own policy because they're so big, they can flex their muscle and they can get something like that done. So when you're looking for something like that, you certainly can go to an independent broker. You could call somebody like us or any independent broker and say, I'm looking for some life insurance. Here's my situation. What do you think would work for me? And get some quotes. There are some companies that you can call and just, you know, pretty much any company that you can call and get quotes from. I would say it's been my experience. It's not necessarily always true. But when you get the flyer in the mail that says, just check this box and pay this much and there's no premiums or anything due, you know, maybe go shopping.
It's, yeah,
you know, that's a little too easy to just for me to just say, yeah, tick the box and pay the money.
So yeah. I was going to say, you know, if you're listening to this show right now and you don't have life insurance and you're thinking about getting it, what are the first steps? What are the first things you would look for? Obviously, I think you said, you know, call a broker.
Yeah, I think so. But before you do that, I think start to think about why you need life insurance, if you need life insurance and what it does for you. So here's some examples.
Okay.
Let's say, as I said earlier, maybe you're a person with a family, and if you pass away, they cannot make ends meet without you, right? Okay, that's a reason to put some life insurance on yourself. Now, people will say, well, it's expensive. I don't want to pay those premiums. Think about it this way. If you were paying $100 a month for a premium, I forget whether it's affordable for you or not, just for this exercise, but let's say you're paying $100 a month for a premium, and you're buying a $100,000 term policy. How long would you have to shell out $100 a month to lose the game? I mean, you're leveraging your money by so much when you buy life insurance. You pay $100 and you die tomorrow, they pay $100,000. That's the life insurance game. You're probably never going to pay in $100,000 in premiums at $100 a month, right, to cover that death benefit. So that's the idea, is that you can use your money to leverage it. So that's one example of when you might need life insurance. Another is, let's suppose you have 3 kids at home and you know, your spouse could do okay, but the kids can't get through college without that money. Here's a very simple one. You have plenty of money. You don't care. Your spouse is going to be fine. You really want to spend down those assets, you know, for your burial and for other things, or do you just want to leverage your money and spend a few dollars and buy some life insurance? They're going to get the proceeds. Beneficiaries get life insurance proceeds tax-free. So, you know, you might, let's say you're a multimillionaire. So pick up a few million of life insurance for next to nothing. You know, it doesn't cost you much to do it. And if you die, that money is available tax-free instead of them having to liquidate assets to do things like pay a mortgage on your home until it gets through probate or on your investment properties or something like that. We talked about a key man policy or a buyout policy for a partner. You might need life insurance for that. When do you not need life insurance? Well, if you're not concerned about your burial costs at all, some people prepay their burial costs. And they simply don't care. They don't have assets to protect. They don't care about, they don't have any debt, right? Their spouse is going to be okay. They don't have children going through college. I hate to say it, but I'm an example of this, right? I'm a single person with no children, no worry, you know, I can pay for whatever I want, right? But I have life insurance. And I have life insurance because it leverages my money. Why would I not spend a pittance, relatively speaking, and leave somebody a lot of life insurance? And in my case, you know, it's family members and charity, right? So You might not need life insurance, but you might want life insurance. I can fund a school or a project about Bengals or whatever I want to fund with my life insurance when I die for almost no money, and they're going to get it tax-free.
Mm-hmm. Which is smart.
Yeah. So to simplify that, I think you need life insurance first to cover your burial costs, second to cover any income that might be needed, third to protect your assets and send your kids to college, right? But that's income related. And fourth is just because you want to. You want to give back to somebody. And rather mm-hmm. than leaving them all your assets, you leave them a life insurance policy. It's a great way to give to charity, for one thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if your spouse comes to you and says they want to take out a $5 million policy on you, at what point should you go to the police? I feel like this is how every Dateline starts.
You know, I don't know that you go to the police. I mean, I have a couple that came to mind immediately when you said that, because he did call me and say, it was $10 million, but I want a $10 million policy on my wife.
You and Keith Morrison are going to be sitting down together very soon. I'm just letting you know now.
Well, I hope not, because I have her on video saying, yes, I want it. And then she said, but I want a $10 million policy on him.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was reasonable. And we actually talked about it, and it turned out that they didn't quite need that. I think we did 8.5 on each of them or whatever. But whatever it was, we found something within their price range that covered them both. And we talked about all those reasons that they have to have it or want it. And again, for them, it was largely about protecting a business, protecting assets, making sure their kids were okay when they were gone. What if their kids ran the business into the ground? Can they still survive?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The real kinds of life things that people think about. I want to talk about term insurance before we end this, though, because, you know, it gets a bit of a bad rap sometimes, or too mm-hmm. good of a rap, depending on who you speak with, because people say, well, term insurance, it's cheap. It covers my death benefit. It's great. And I'm not going to need it when I'm older, because mm-hmm. I'll have plenty of money.
Okay.
It might be true, but right. What happens if you do need it? And mm-hmm. here's the thing. We talked about guaranteed life, guaranteed issue, because I don't think people really know the nuts and bolts of it. And for term insurance, I want to bring up this topic, because this is maybe the most important reason to pick up term insurance when you can't afford or don't want a more expensive policy.
Okay.
Most term insurance is what we call guaranteed renewable or guaranteed convertible. And what that okay. means is that when you're young and healthy and you can afford the $25 a month premium to buy your $250,000 policy, mm-hmm. you are protecting yourself in the future, yourself, not your family. I mean, you are protecting your family, but you're protecting yourself in the future in case you become uninsurable or rateable. In other words, let's suppose you're young and healthy now, you pick up $25 a month and you pay the term. And let's mm-hmm. say it's a 25, let's say it's a 30-year term policy.
Okay.
And you're 25 years old. By the time you're 55 years old, you might have some health problems. Mm-hmm. You might have diabetes, for instance. It doesn't have to be some terminal disease, right? Maybe you just have AFib, okay? But that might mean that you may not be eligible for reasonably priced or eligible at all for a whole life policy or even another term policy. Mm-hmm. However, the term policy you have is probably guaranteed convertible, which means that they will have to, even if you're terminally ill, they have to give you, convert that insurance if you ask them to, some or all of it, you get to choose, mm-hmm. To some form of permanent insurance. And you're going to get it based on your healthy rate you bought it at when you were 25.
So that's kind of a benefit to buying early.
It is, because if you got, let's say, a preferred non-smoker rate, you know, you're out there running marathons and you don't have to be that. You just have to be in good health and non-smoking. Mm-hmm. But if you get preferred non-smoker rates, you're going to get a very inexpensive premium. Get to age 55 or 60 or 65, and now you maybe have some health problems, you're still going to get a preferred non-smoker rate, but you will have to pay for it at your current age. Still, mm-hmm. it's a great deal if you want to convert some of it. And what some people do is they pick up, you know, $500,000 term when they're young. And by the time they're getting to retirement, they're looking at, okay, my term policy is going to end. Maybe I should convert some of it. Maybe they convert $50,000 to permanent mm-hmm. insurance and they let the rest of it go or whatever. Or they do some sort of term and whole life blend. But it's really worth it for people with a term policy. Anybody listening to this who has a term policy, who is just living under the idea that My term policy will end, and then what? You should check to see if it's guaranteed convertible and maybe get some quotes from your broker. Hey, what would it cost me to convert 25,000 of this? 50,000, 10,000, what can I do? Find out what your options are while you have that term insurance in place. Don't just let it end without knowing what it does. That's perhaps the most under-exercised value point I could give you today, is to check on your term insurance and see if you want to start converting pieces of it. You could even convert, you know, I want to convert 25,000 this year. I'm going to convert another 25,000 next year, things like that. And your broker should be able to help you do that.
Quick question about, back to what we talked about in the beginning with the employee that usually offers you, if you want to do one, two, three times your salary for insurance. If you have a separate whole life insurance, do you need to do that? I mean, it seems like with the employee, it's really cheap to be able to do that. Is it smart to just do that in addition?
Yeah, I think for the money they charge you. I mean, it was $7 a paycheck or something to get three times your salary. I think it is a really good idea to do that. You do, however, want to check with your HR people and see if your employer is offering you accidental death benefit or real life insurance. I mean, I've seen some people, believe it or not, paying a premium that they thought, and it looked like it was high enough to be real life insurance. And really, it was for an accidental policy. It only paid if they were in an accident or if they lost one limb or one eye or one hand, you know. And they were paying these premiums for something that may or may not ever happen, which is fine if they're really cheap premiums. You know, you see that ADD on your, you know, it's $1.15 or whatever. That might be worth it. But just know what you got. I mean, that's the whole deal, is ask your broker, ask your HR person. Have some independent person take a look at it and help you sort through it, but know what you have. And really, it can be such a tool for people. I mean, you know, we don't talk about it very often because it sort of is one of those, I don't know, it's sort of one of those background things. People go, yeah, and I have some life insurance. And then I say, do you know if it's whole life or term? I don't know. Does it build any cash value? I don't know. I think so. How much is it? I'll say, how much is the cash value? They'll say $200,000. I say, that's the cash value? I don't know. That's what they pay when I die. That's your death benefit, right? So we just don't talk about it. Nobody wants to talk about dying. And nobody certainly wants to talk about buying a policy that they must die within the term of, Jess.
Right. I don't think they're hiring me for the advertising campaign for that.
I don't know. I think,
if you think you're going to kick off within 10 years, we'll pay you.
I love that you say things like that, because I think it's what we all think, you know, is
just don't say
I'm sending this money out. What, you know, what good is it to me? I'm going to be dead. But there are features that you can access when you're alive, especially in some form of permanent insurance. But yeah, just know what you've got. Use it to protect your assets. Use it as an estate planning tool. And people say, well, I'm going to leave my house to my son or daughter. Now, if you leave it to your spouse, it's not such a big deal. But you're leaving it to a child. If you haven't done a life estate, a legal document to do that, then, you know, they're inheriting your house. Well, that's fine. But now your will is in probate, maybe for 6 months, maybe for longer. Just because you have a will doesn't mean they get the money immediately. It has to go through probate court.
Are they going to have the money to run that?
Yeah, a mortgage, repairs, whatever. And the life insurance, you know, they'd have it in a week, 10 days in their hand, tax-free.
All right, well, let's get your phone number. There's a lot to this. So let's get your phone number if people have questions.
Sure. It's 413-773-3333.
All right, perfect. You can also go to hugyourmoney.com. We'll be back next week with another episode of the Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Rahm, right here on WHMP. Thank you.
Thank you, Jess.